Devaya. Anucharai. Samanuvarnita. Virya. Anucharai Samanuvarnita Virya. Anucharai Samanuvarnita Virya. Adi Purusha Ivachala Bhuti. Adi Purusha Ivachala Bhuti. Adi Purusha Ivachala Bhuti. Anucharai Samanuvarnita Virya. Adi Purusha Ivachala Bhuti. Vana Charo Giri Tateshu Charantir. Vanacharo Giri Tateshu Charantir. Vanacharo Giri Tateshu Charantir. Venunah. Sorry, I'm just trying to say the word. That's a couple of words stuck together. Venunahavayati. Ga. Sa. Yada. Hi. Venunahavayati ga. Sa. Yada. Hi. Venunai vayati ga sayadahi. Vanacharo giri tateshu charanti. Venunai vayati ga sayadahi. Anucharai samanuvarnita virya. Adi purusha. Ivachala Bhuti. Vanacharo Giri Tateshu Charantir. Venunavayati Ghasa Yadahi. Anuchatastarava Atmani Vishnum Vanjayantya Iva Pushpa Palaladhyā. Pranata bharavitapa madhudhara prema rishta tanavo vavishusma dashaniya tilako vanamala divyaganda tulasi madhumatai alikulaya laka kitam abhishtam adriyanyahi sandhita venu sarasi sarasa hangsa vihangash charu gita hrita cetasa etya Harimvapastata teyata chita handa midita jisho drittamona. Okay, so the transliteration. Anucharai. By Vrindavan, his name is Virasvara. It means like, you know, like Vira means like powerful, and Virasvara means he's like the controller of all powerful people. So it's another name of Krishna. Adi Purusha, the original personality of Godhead. Eva, as if. And we're seeing the translation here that the Gopis are saying he appears as if he's the supreme personality of Godhead, but actually he's not. And then later on we'll read, and they say, and then, you know, like all the trees and etc., the filaments on their body are standing on ecstasy of love of Godhead. So it's kind of interesting, because in one point they're saying, but he looks like God, but he's not. And the other point is saying, but they're all reacting out of love of Godhead. So, interesting. Achala, unchanging. Bhuti, whose opulences. Achala also means unmoving. Because just like the temple is called an Achala Viman. In South India, you'll hear this term. It means it's like just like you have a viman, like when the deity goes onto the chariot, that's called a chala viman. Means like a moving viman, means a carrier. Oftentimes, it means also an airplane. Like you hear this term pushpa viman, which means a flower airplane. So the temple is called a chala viman. Means it doesn't move. It's the carrier of the Lord, but it doesn't move. So also in the temple, the deity is called the chala murti. Means that when the deities are installed, they should never be moved. Yeah. Some places actually glue them, but you'll find that in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, in our Sampradaya, it's that generally the deities aren't moved because there's been so many incidences in the past where we have to move them, so that they're generally not glued down. You'll find, you know, like the deities of all the Goswamis are not glued. And even you can go to, what's that temple in Vrindavan? It's one of the Goswami temples in Vrindavan. Radha Shamasunda. And they sometimes throughout the year they do, especially in if anyone has the opportunity to go to for Kartik in Vrindavan, then the last 5 days of Kartik are called Bhishma Panchaka. Nothing to do with Bhishma Day, but it just means like these are like 5 days where you can perform really intense brathas, and you'll get the benefit as if you've done this all throughout Kartik, all throughout Chaturmasya, sorry. And if you go around to the Goswami temples during these times, you'll see all these different darshans. And there's one darshan they do at Radha Shamasunda, where they take Shamasundaji and they put him up on top of a form of Kaliya. And it's kind of interesting because they've got him all tied up with ropes so he doesn't fall down. You can see all the ropes and stuff. But it's kind of interesting because he's a big deity. He's like about this tall. So obviously they've made some significant arrangement for him to stand up there. But he's on top of Kaliya. It's a very nice darshan. So every day you'll see all these different darshans. But generally speaking, the deity doesn't move like that. And, you know, they do those things in those temples, but not that we should do things like that in ISKCON. It's not very safe. Bhuti, whose opulences? Vana, in the forest. Chara, moving about. Giri, of the mountains. Tateshu, on the sides. Charantihi, who are grazing. Venuna, with his flute. Avayati, calls. Gaha, the cows. Saha, he. Yada, when. He, indeed. Actually, this is so long it might go on for quite a while. Maybe we'll just read the... Because there's many words here that you could speak quite a little bit about. There's one interesting word in the third verse, and it says Darshaniya Tilako Vanamala. So this is talking, the acharyas give different translations on this. In the verse, Pridana Maharaj and the devotees have translated it as, let me see if I can just quickly find it. He translated as the most beautiful of all persons, or the one who's like, you know, so beautiful to see. Darshaniya Tilako. So Tilako can mean different things. Also, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he gives another translation meaning that whose Tilak is very beautiful to see. So Tilak is a generic term. It's not a specific term. Like often we refer to this as Tilak. It is a kind of Tilak. And in particular, it's what they call Urva Pundra Tilak. So it means like two upward going lines. You know, you see the other sampradayas have this like three lines going across. And you'll see all different types of tilaks. But Gaudiya Vaishnava tilak in particular is called Urdhva Pundra tilak. So generally when you see a reference like this talking about tilak, it doesn't necessarily mean that Krishna is wearing this type of tilak. Rather it means that he has different decorations on his body. And here specifically is referring to, as we see in the previous two verses, verse 5 and 6, that he decorates his body with all the different ochres, you know, the red ochres and stuff. I don't know if you remember, maybe, you know, some of you are a little bit older may remember, in Australia it was quite a popular thing to stain a fence, you know, a timber fence with red ochre. You don't see it very often these days, but you used to see actually very poisonous stuff. They used to mix it with some things that weren't very, very nice. But you know, like Krishna would take these ochres and these natural dyes from the earth, and he would decorate his body with it, with this, and in this way he would become very beautiful, and this darshaniya, very pleasing to see. Yeah? And it's interesting because we see here that Krishna's performing these extraordinary pastimes, and they have, for different people, they have different effects. For someone who's a materialist, to say, how can you say that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Here he is, he's rubbing dirt on his body. He's playing in the forest just like an ordinary, dirty boy. Just like you see, anyone who's had young boys, you know, they like to go out and they play in the mud and they do all sorts of things, you know, they come home and they walk the mud through the house. I remember when we were kids, you know, whenever it rained, you know, the puddles would come, so what we'd do is we'd go and, you know, like jump in the puddles and try and soak our friends with the water in the puddles. So in the process, we'd become completely drenched and they'd become completely drenched. You know, and you'd play in mud and all different types of things like that. So Krishna's also doing the same things. And the materialistic people, they become bewildered by this. They think, oh, this can't be God. How can God do this? Even Lord Brahma became bewildered. And this is like the prelude to the Brahma Vimohan Lila. He heard that, oh, Krishna has descended. Yeah, of course, Krishna revealed to him that he was going to descend, but by the influence of Krishna's yoga maya potency, Lord Brahma did not understand that. So he had heard that Krishna was his cowherd boy playing in Vrindavan. So he went down to see, oh, I want to see what my master is doing. No, because he's a great devotee of Lord Krishna, and he's very interested to witness the glorious pastimes of Krishna, because he understood that these were supposed to be the most super excellent pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so he went to see Lord Krishna performing pastimes with the cowherd boys. And then he saw that they were sitting in the forest and eating their lunch. And they would be stealing things from Krishna's lunchbox and eating them. They'd be stealing Krishna's remnants, things that he'd taken bites from and eating them. And he would also be doing the same. He would be stealing their remnants and eating them. And he thought, this is not my master. This cannot be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because he has an Aishwarya conception. Therefore, he cannot understand these types of pastimes. So he thought, no, this can't be my master. I will test him out. I think this is just an ordinary cowherd boy. I will test him out. Therefore, he stole all the calves and all the cowherd boys. Brahma stole them and he imprisoned them in a cave. And Krishna, being the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, he immediately manifested himself as all those calves and cowherd boys. Exactly the same. No different. And Krishna's pastimes, so extraordinary. I was reflecting on this before when I was reading this, how fortunate we are that through the mercy of the acharyas like Sukadeva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives these lovely commentaries on the Bhagavatam, and then also Srila Prabhupada, we get the opportunity not just to read about Krishna's pastimes, because you can go and get many books in India which will discuss the pastimes of Krishna. You can even get, like, Gita Press has put out a two-volume version of the Bhagavatam, which is, there's some interesting, you know, points they make there, but still, they don't elaborate on the pastimes the same way that the acharyas do. So, you know, by the mercy of our acharyas, we're actually able to understand the deeper meaning of these pastimes. Because, you know, for an ordinary person, when they read these different types of things, they cannot understand what is going on. You know, Krishna's rolling around in the dirt, he's rolling and playing in mud, he's running around imitating, you know, the frogs, imitating the monkeys, you know, making, you know, just like you see, you go to Vrindavan now and you see the boys, you know, they tease the monkeys there. Yeah? So Krishna does exactly the same thing. And people become bewildered. So we see Lord Brahma, he became bewildered. And then Krishna manifested himself as all those calves and all those cowherd boys for the period of a year. And the pastime is so extraordinary. He's like, no one detected that anything was going on. Everyone got the opportunity, because all the gopis and the gopas, they were desiring, oh Krishna, he's so beautiful, he's so wonderful, I wish he was my son. And so for a year he was. And the cows, they're thinking the same thing. Oh, this Krishna, he's so wonderful. I wish he was my calf. I wish he was my child. And so Krishna fulfilled their desires. And the gopis were thinking, you know, they're performing, this is just after Katyayani Brat. They performed this Brat, you know, for a period of a month and saying, you know, they're offering this prayer, Katyayani Mahimahe Mahayogini. They're praying, you know, you please make the son of the, oh Mother Katyayani, oh, you know, Supreme Maya, all this, all that, you know, you please make the son of Nanda Maharaj my husband. So he did, they did. in that year, according to the comments of the Acharyas. They all got married. So the way that Krishna reciprocates with devotees is extraordinary. You know, he fulfills all their desires. And even we see, I was reading Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur's commentaries on this, and he was. We'll read the verse soon. And it talks in the verse, in the second part of the verse, it talks about how the bees, you know, they're maddened by the aroma of the tulsi, because in Krishna's garland, you see it in Mayapur sometimes, when they make the garlands, they put all these tulsi manjaris. Of course, the garlands in Mayapur are about this fat, you know, so what they do, rather than actually sowing the tulsi in there, Korma Chaitanya Prabhu, he just gets like handfuls of tulsi and jams them in between the dahlias, so they're just like all these like, you know, opulent tulsi garlands. And it's describing here how the bees are just maddened by the aroma of tulsi. And so they're just, you know, they're just buzzing around the garland, smelling this beautiful aroma of tulsi. And it's interesting because Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur talks about the aroma of tulsi, because usually when you get a tulsi manjari, you can't smell the aroma. But then he also describes how in the morning, I'm sure you've experienced this when you go into a tulsi house, the tulsi has this lovely, warm, moist aroma. And actually, no one can appreciate the aroma of tulsi like Krishna. There's a verse in the third canto which talks about the wonderful nature of Krishna and how all these glorious flowers are offering obeisances to tulsi because she's so wonderful. And even Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur talks about how tulsi, the aroma of tulsi is even more wonderful than that of a lotus. I remember several years ago, because generally you get the lotuses coming in the hot season. So of course you know it doesn't get hot enough down here for lotuses, so you won't see them very often. But I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Mayapur at the end of the summer, and they're offering lotuses to Radha Madhava. Beautiful, and they had these white lotuses and a very beautiful aroma. And actually, the aroma reminded me of a malted milkshake. And it just had this like malt smell to it, you know, but much. Like honey and cream, and you know, it's really, really nice aroma, and you know, it's considered to be one of the most wonderful aromas. Yet tulsi, the aroma of tulsi is even more significant than that, more special than that. Anyhow, so Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, he's talking about the reciprocation of Krishna with his devotees. He's talking about how the swarms of honeybees are they're just like buzzing around the garland, trying to experience the nectar of tulsi. And then Krishna, he's listening to their humming, because he's got his flute poised on his lips. He's just about to blow his flute, and he's listening to their humming. He goes, "Excellent, excellent! This is the perfect note." And he plays the note that the bees are singing. Yeah? So he's reciprocating. He's increasing their ecstasy even more. And we see that all the pastimes Krishna is performing is simply for this point of increasing the ecstasy of his devotees. He's reciprocating so perfectly, yeah, with all the desires. And we see, you know, if we look back through all the different pastimes that have been here, you know, starting off with, you know, Devaki and Vasudev, they perform, you know, austerities in a previous life to have Krishna as their son. So they got Krishna. And you look, you know, all the different incarnations that have come about because the devotees have performed some kind of austerity in order to get Krishna as a son, or they wanted to have some interaction with Krishna. So Krishna has interacted perfectly with his devotees in order to enhance their loving relationship with him. So this is the process of devotional service. It's all about reciprocation. And not just with Krishna. Obviously, you know, the prime reciprocation we have is with Krishna, the prime living entity. Yet we see that devotional service is all about developing reciprocation with all levels of living entities. And we see this is discussed by our acharyas. You know, in the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, you can read about it. In the books of Rupa Goswami, you can read about it. He talks about the different, you know, the different levels of advancement in devotional service. You know, the Uttam, the Madhyam, and the Kanishtha Adhikari, and the reciprocations that should be there. Yeah. And we see that in Vaishnava dealings, that there is a great degree of sensitivity. That we should be aware, or try to be aware of a person's level of advancement, and then interact with them in a way that is just suitable. And of course, you know, when we discuss the different rasas, there's five primary rasas and seven secondary rasas. when we discuss the different rasas, we need to understand what is the relationship between us and a certain person. You know, is this person equal? Is this person senior? Is this person junior? Is this person, do I have a relationship with this person in this ras? Is it, you know, like a neutral ras? Is it friendship? Is it like a conjugal ras? Is it a relationship of a parent-child like that? And then act accordingly. But of course we see in Kali Yuga, everything is completely topsy-turvy. Even we hear of children having conjugal relationships with their parents. Sometimes willingly, sometimes not. Such a crazy time we live in, you know, and it's getting crazier and crazier. I was discussing with Gopal Guru yesterday. There was this gentleman in the temple who unfortunately was, you know, he has some mental disorder. And so, you know, the police had to come and remove him from the temple. And you will see, I mean, of course, over the years we have seen many such people like that, especially around Gaupanim. They seem to be attracted to Gaupanim because it's such a beautiful full moon. And around Gaupanim we seem to get a lot of people like that. But we will see, as Kali Yuga progresses, that this becomes more and more prevalent. You know, you'll find most of the people who come to the temple will be completely crazy. It's just the way it's going to develop. And it's interesting. I was listening to this class by Ravindra Sarup a few days ago, and it was talking about Grihastha Ashram. And he was pointing out one of the reasons why people become like this. And it all gets back to this sensitivity to the relationship, understanding what is the relationship and understanding what is your duty in a relationship. And we see that Rishabh Dev, he points out that, you know, he says, Guru Nasya Satsa Janona Sasa Pitana Sat Janani Nasa Sat. He says that one should not become a guru. Guru Nasya Sat. Don't become. And one should not become a demigod, a father, a mother, a friend, a leader. Shouldn't become any of these things. Unless, he says, one is capable of delivering the dependence to the lotus feet of Mukunda. So we see, Ravindra Sarup, he's pointing out that what happens is, like, you know, a child goes through different phases, which is pointed out by Chanaka Pandit. Prabhupada also talks about this, that when they're from 1 to 5, you know, you should just, you know, pour affection upon that child. You just make them, you know, like, basically let them do it. Of course, you don't let them do things that are going to hurt them, but you let them do whatever they want, you know, and you're just so affectionate to them. And we see, just like I was watching Mataji with your daughter's name is Rasika, right? Yeah? How when she was walking in here, like little children, they're sometimes a little bit unsteady on their feet. So Mataji's behind and she's putting her hand here so Rasika doesn't bang into the pillar, and making sure she doesn't bang into the door. Just all affection is there. Yeah? And we see what happens is when the children are given that affection, then they're emotionally well balanced. Yeah? Because they have an emotional need at that point in their life. And they need to be dealt with in this way, so they become well-rounded. And then when they get to the next stage of their life, it's pointed out that one should be very firm with them. You have to teach them. Huh? Oh, you don't do this, you don't do it like that, etc., like that, and you go on like that. And even Prabhupada talks about this one example of when he was a grihastha, and his son kept wanting to stick his finger into the fan. And Prabhupada was admonishing, no, don't do this, he was restraining. And his friend said, no, he will never learn like that. Let him stick his finger. Turn the fan off, let him stick his finger. So Prabhupada turned the fan off, and the child put his finger, tang, like that, you know, straight, he got hit by the fan. Never did it again. And that's the thing, there needs to be a little bit of learning there. If you just always keep the child away, no, don't do this, you know, then the learning is more didactic. But when there's some, and actually there's a statement from Confucius where he says, you tell me, I will forget. I don't remember all the details, but he says, he talks about, I've forgotten it, I'm sorry. He talks about how, you know, if you just tell me about it, it's just going to go in one ear and out the other. You know? But then if someone gets a chance to experience the things, then they will remember, I will learn. He makes that point, you know, if I experience, I will learn. So the same with children, you know, you have to allow them to experience things so they'll actually learn. Yeah? So the point we're making here is that, like, throughout the childhood, there's all these different steps. And in the middle stages, from about 5 or 6 up to 15, 16, you see the change in a person's consciousness. It's not that, like, okay, now you've turned 5, we're going to start beating you with a stick. Of course, we never beat our children with sticks. This is not at all suitable. Yeah? Yet what is meant there is, it says you raise them with a stick, it means you become firm. The rod of chastisement is there. And we see that sometimes Mother Yasoda, she chased Krishna with a stick. But did she beat him with that stick? Of course not. But that's the rod of chastisement. It's like the threat of chastisement. It's not that you hit them with it, but they understand, oh, now Mother is angry. Huh? So when the child has that mentality changes, then we become very firm with them. We teach them. And there's a story that Prabhupada tells of a young boy. And his parents died, and he was raised by his auntie. And then all throughout this auntie could not understand these delineations. All throughout life, this child was doing things that were not quite right, and the people would come and complain, and she said, oh no, not my boy, he would never do things like that. And every time someone would come and complain, no, he couldn't do things, he's such a nice boy, he's an angel. Huh? So she never chastised him. And then later on, as he grew up in life, he wound up murdering someone, and he was caught by the police. Huh? And then he was in court, and he was being tried. You know, they stand him in the docks and they have them all handcuffed and stuff like that. And you know, he had his hands cuffed behind his back, so he couldn't move very much. And then so he was convicted and sentenced to death. So then they asked, do you have any last requests or anything last words to say? And he says, yes, I would just like to speak to my auntie. And they said, okay. So they called his auntie over, and he said, auntie, come closer. I want to whisper something in your ear. And she came over and said, no, closer, closer. And she came right close to his mouth like that. And then he bit her ear off. And she was like mortified. Why did you do that? Yeah? And he says, because you never instructed me once. You never corrected me once. And therefore I am the way I am. Yeah? So this is an instructive story that Srila Prabhupada was using to demonstrate the duty. Yeah? So it's important that devotees understand our duties, you know, in different roles of life. And then, of course, when the child gets around to that period of, like, you know, 15, 16, then Prabhupada says you become their friend. Because, and I'm sure we've all experienced this, you know, especially those who are not so far out of our teens, is like, if you're a teenager and your parents are chastising you or correcting you all the time, how do you react to it? Huh? Rebel. Yeah, you rebel. It generally pushes you away. Because, you know, you figure, well, now I'm an adult, you know, now I know what I want in life and stuff like that, you know. So when the parents become the friend, you know, you'll find that is very, very helpful. You know? And rather than pushing the child away, by being their friend, you're embracing them. You know? So it's a different thing. So understanding relationships, and this is a very important aspect of Vaishnavism, is that one understands the relationship. You know, at various parts of life, and also in terms of who it is we're relating to. Yet we see, you know, because like understanding what the relationship of a parent is, understanding that, you know, like with a baby, that I have to give this child so much affection. Therefore, it gives the child the opportunity to develop into a well-rounded person. Yet we see what materialistic people are doing. What do? You know, they've got their career. This is the God, is the career. Right? And they have this career, and they put everything else on hold for the career. And you'll find that even sometimes, you know, finally, you know, men and women, they're getting into their mid to late 30s, and they decide, oh, okay, now, you know, I've got my career established, let's have a child. And what they'll do then is they'll have a child, they go on maternity leave for, you know, like 6 months to a year. When the child's 6 or 7 months, what do they do? Put the child in a crèche. Right, so then the child, you know, doesn't have that affection from its mother, doesn't have the guidance from its, but that warm, you know, household environment. So then what happens is as the child grows up, because it's emotionally deprived and because it's not getting like the whole sort of, you know, guidance and relationship, etc., with the parents, it just knows the people in these different institutions, these you know, nurseries and stuff like that, and who knows what type of people they are, the different children they get to interact with. You know, I remember, you know, I mean, I'm sure some of you have had different experiences, but I remember my experience of going to primary school is they were probably the most hurtful people I ever dealt with in my life. You know, I remember when my father died, that was in high school, but everyone was making jokes about it. All the kids at school was, oh, you know, what happened to your father? Did he get eaten by a penguin or something? You know, they're just making all these, like, you know, because my father died down in Antarctica. And they're just making all these, like, terrible jokes about it. which indicates a complete lack of sensitivity, which indicates that they themselves have not been nurtured when they've been, you know, brought up. And this is what's happening, because people don't understand the relationships. Yet we see here Krishna is demonstrating perfectly how to relate with different living entities, and he's encouraging them and nurturing them and inspiring them to greater and greater degrees of Krishna consciousness, greater and greater degrees of surrender. And as we've mentioned numerous times, that the pinnacle of that surrender is the gopis of Vrindavan, because they are 100% surrender to Krishna. There's nothing else in their lives. So by understanding relationships, by nurturing people, whatever their stage of relationship is, it's good for us to understand these things, to understand, where I am. And actually, Vishnu Charavati Thakur in Madhuri Kadambini, he discusses this very clearly. He discusses all the different degrees of advancement in devotional service and symptoms, so you can understand where you're situated, and also to help you understand where others are situated. So this gives us, a framework of how to interact with others. Then, of course, when we see that someone is very, very advanced devotee, yes, I was listening to this Nectar Devotion class, and Prabhupada was talking about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and there's one song of Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he's talking that, he's expressing humility. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his books, he has different sections. One section is where he may express humility, and another section where he expresses regret, and he goes through all these different emotions. And in this one, he's expressing such deep humility, and he's saying, I'm going to be born again because I'm such a sinful person, but being born as Lord Brahma is of no use to me. I don't want that. And you look at the position of Lord Brahma, he's the most elevated living entity in this universe. He says, but, if I could just be born as an insect in a house of devotee, this would be a perfect birth for me. So, we see elevated souls, then this is their mood, is they're considering that actually, I'm so fallen, I'm so insignificant, everyone else is more advanced than me. And then Prabhupada was saying, he said, this is not bluff. This is they actually feel like this. And this is important, to understand that, a very, very advanced devotee. And of course we see that materialistic people misunderstand this. Even sometimes we see materialistic Vaishnavas, just like with Gaurakishore Das Babaji. There's a well-known story about Gaurakishore Das Babaji, that not long before he died, he it wasn't really a last will and testament, but he let devotees know that of his feelings, that, when I die, you drag my body through the street so it can be kicked and beaten. He's just saying that, I consider that I'm such an insignificant person, I'm not worthy of any proper funeral rites, of anything like this. I should be kicked and beaten and, left out for the dogs to eat. This was his humility. And the extraordinary thing is that some people actually wanted to do that. They wanted to take his body and drag it through the streets of Navadvip. And then quite an amazing pastime, when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he came to claim the body, and he challenged them all, that they don't have the right. I won't go into the whole story, but it's quite an interesting story. He challenged them all that you don't have the right to take his body, and he established, through different challenges, that actually he had the right, and then he went and put his body into samadhi. So we see that this is quite common in advanced devotees, is that they actually express the complete lack of any spiritual advancement. Yet, getting back to the point here, is that we need to understand, through study of Shastra, etc., and seeing, our own behavior, how I act in different degrees. Prabhupada was talking on this class on Nectar Devotion yesterday, how we should not become puffed up and think that we're, advanced devotee or senior devotee or anything like this, but just, humbly perform devotional service. He says, in this way, we can actually understand Krishna, we can actually know Krishna. Because we see, as we go back a few chapters in Krishna's pastimes, when the gopis had a little bit of pride, because the gopis are not proud. You hear the way they're talking about Krishna here. They're considering themselves, just like in the previous verse, they were talking about how, because we're so unqualified, we don't get the opportunity to embrace Krishna with our arms. Yet they're the most qualified. There's no one more qualified than the gopis of Vrindavan because of the humility. This is one of their qualifications. So in one of the previous chapters, they expressed a small amount of pride. Oh, we're so lucky. we're the only ones with Krishna. And it's true, they are so lucky. They are the only ones with Krishna, and they're so qualified. Yet Krishna, he doesn't like that pride. And so he disappeared from the rasa dance. So in the same for us, you know, if we have any pride, it's keeping Krishna distant from us. Yeah? This humility is considered to be one of the crest jewels of the Vaishnava. If we can just be adorned with humility, then this is going to be such a powerful thing in attracting Krishna. So Prabhupada was pointing that out in his classes. That was a very, very nice point. And he was, you know, bringing up these things. And he brought up this, I think I quoted it once before, this verse from Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. Again, we see, you know, these senior Vaishnavas express such incredible humility. He was saying that there's a verse, it's in the fifth chapter of the Adalila. He says that, I am lower than a worm in stool. I'm more sinful than Jagai and Madhai. And he says that anyone who hears my name loses the result of all their pious activity. And anyone who chants my name becomes sinful. And he believed it. It wasn't like he was just saying that, saying, you know, oh, I'm so humble, you know, see how humble I am, I'll tell you all about this, you know. He actually felt that way. You know, so what happened was he was talking about the glories of Nityananda Ram. And then how Nityananda had appeared to him in a dream and told him, go to Vrindavan. And yet he considered that he was so unqualified to go to Vrindavan. You know, why are you asking me to go there? I have no qualification here. He said, but out of Lord Nityananda's mercy, he has instructed me to go there. Therefore, I'm doing it. And the same, you know, when Govinda Basu was written by Baladev Vidyabhushan, right? And when Baladev Vidyabhushan, when he wrote Govinda Basya, he felt completely unqualified to do it. But he was instructed by Govinda Dev to do it. And then so he went and took the blessings of the different Vaishnavas. Krishnadas Kaviraj, when he wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the same thing. He felt completely unqualified to do it. And therefore he was instructed by all the senior Vaishnavas. And one thing I find very interesting is who was it? There's one pastime where a devotee, I think he, just like with Lokanath Goswami, you won't find him mentioned here, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, as I remember, the story goes that Krishnadas Kaviraj was going around and asking different Vaishnavas for their blessings. And then Lokanath Goswami, he gave the blessing, yes, I'll give you the blessing for the Chaitanya Charitamrita on one provision. And he said, well, what's that, Goswami? He says, you do not talk about me in there. They're such humble souls, you know, they don't want to be glorified in any way. So we see, and these are the persons who actually understand these pastimes. These are the persons who are able to enlighten us with their pastimes. So not only are the pastimes inspiring, but when we see the quality of the persons who are enlightening us with the pastimes, these are also very, very inspiring. So I'll read this wonderful translation. And I was discussing this with my wife yesterday and this morning about these, you know, she was just saying that these pastimes are just not of this world. And it's a fact, when you read these pastimes for a devotee and you hear, you know, the descriptions that are there and what's actually happening in Vrindavan, you can realize that this is not the material world. This is the spiritual world. And that's why, you know, I consider to be so fortunate to have this opportunity. We're all so fortunate just to be able to hear these extraordinary pastimes of Krishna. Krishna moves about in the forest in the company of his friends, who vividly chant the glories of his magnificent deeds. He thus appears just like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, exhibiting his inexhaustible opulences. When the cows wander onto the mountainsides, and Krishna calls out to them with the sound of his flute, the trees and creepers in the forest respond by becoming so luxuriant with fruits and flowers that they seem to be manifesting Lord Vishnu within their hearts. See the reciprocation that's going on there? You know, like Krishna's presence, he's blowing his flute, and the trees and the creepers and all the plants, they give their fruit, their opulences, they produce their opulences in order to reciprocate with Krishna. And Krishna walks past and he strokes them with his hands and he plays their flute in a way that's pleasing to them. There's such a wonderful reciprocation going on all the time. As their branches bend low with the weight, and actually this reminds me of something, because they're so burdened with fruits and flowers and stuff, they bend low. There's a story It sort of goes back towards humility. Tukaram was a great Vaishnavacharya and actually a contemporary of Lord Chaitanya, an associate of Lord Chaitanya. And as far as I understand, he took shelter. I'm not sure if he got initiated by Lord Chaitanya or not. But there's a story where he... is it Tukaram or Tulsidas? I'm pretty sure it's Tukaram. He was in the ashram of his spiritual master, and there was another disciple there who was very proud, and he was like the senior disciple, and he was always wanting to get the worship and the glory and stuff, but because, you know, because Tukaram, he was such a humble person, he was always the one who was getting glorified, even though he did not want it. And so one day for this proud disciple, it was just too much for him. He exploded in a rage and he was yelling at the guru and carrying on. He says, why is it that this one always gets the honour? I am the senior disciple. I am more advanced. And then the guru, he used this very interesting analogy, which is similar to this. He says, the tree that carries the most fruit is bent low to the ground, but the tree that is barren stands tall and erect. And he says, you are like that barren tree. So we see that these creepers, these trees, they have so much to give to Krishna, they're bowing to the ground. And so in the same way that someone who's humble is always bowing down to the Lord, bowing down to the Vaishnavas, we see it talks about the Goswamis in that prayer. Srinivasacharya talks about the six Goswamis. He says how they're offering thousands and thousands of obeisances to all the Vaishnavas. Just any Vaishnava who came, they would offer their obeisances. Anyone. You see, sometimes you've got to Vrindavan, there's different sadhus there, that anyone who comes, I'll offer their obeisance to them. They're always blissful, ecstatic, you know. They're very humble. And this is one of the fruits of a Vaishnava, is this humility. And it says, as their branches bend low with the weight, the filaments on their trunks and vines stand erect out of the ecstasy of love of God. And both the trees and the creepers pour down a rain of sweet sap. You can imagine that, you know, Krishna's walking through the forest and all the trees are just producing all these flowers and fruits and stuff are just coming out spontaneously because Krishna is there and coming out all at the same time. And then the trees are bending down, the creepers are bending down. Just try to visualize this, and then they're producing sap, and it's just all these droplets of sap are just like pouring down upon Krishna and Balaram. Such a glorious description. It must be such a wonderful experience. And it's just like sometimes when you go near a waterfall or you go near a fountain. You know how you get that, like the droplets, and you feel that soft spray on your body? So you can imagine just like this honey and sap is just dropping down upon your body. And it's all for the pleasure of Krishna. Maddened by the divine honey-like aroma of the tulsi flowers on the garland Krishna wears, swarms of bees sing loudly for him, and that most beautiful of all persons thankfully acknowledges and acclaims their song by taking his flute to his lips and playing it. And he plays exactly the note that they're singing. He acknowledges their humming. He's reciprocating with them. I remember in Poland, there was a farm down in the southwest of Poland. It's called New Shantipur. It's near a place called Zielona Góra. And very simple farm. Not, you know, they don't have the opulences like we have here. They've got a bit of land there and very nice devotees. And you know, it's quite cold there actually. The snow. I remember one time we went down there. We were doing a tour with the Village of Peace reggae band, and we went down there because we were doing a concert near there. And actually, we're going to the places we're doing the concerts in. Was like, oh God, I hope I never go there again. You know, really degraded places. But it's quite interesting because people were chanting the holy names, and drunk out of their brains, and just, you know, chanting the holy names. We went down there one time. The snow was like this deep. You know, it was just like autumn. It wasn't winter yet. You know, so goodness knows what it's like in the winter. And anyhow, so I was there in the summer one year, and they had these beautiful panchatattva deities made of brass. And I think the deities, they're probably about this tall, you know, onto the top of their heads. And anyhow, so on the altar, they've got like just a straight altar, a flat altar, and then there's a window on the side. And during the summer, it's actually spring, I think. Then the bumblebees, these big, big fat bumblebees about this big, would come in and just hang around the garlands of the deities. You know, so even when Krishna's manifest in his deity form, then the other living entities are so attracted. And just like we see here, how the bees are you know, buzzing around Krishna's, swarming around Krishna's garland to experience the sweet smell of the garland, especially the sweet smell of the tulsi. then we see when Krishna manifests in his deity form, you'll see the same thing, that the bees, etc., they come to experience the sweetness. Because we understand, it's not an ordinary thing. It's not like this is just some ordinary flower garland that Krishna's wearing. Even there's a letter Prabhupada wrote about the jewels the deities wear. And he was saying how that they're not plastic jewels, they're not ordinary jewels. These are actually, these have become transcendental gems, touchstones, because they're in contact with the body of Lord Krishna. And even in the previous verse, it was talking about how inanimate objects become animate because of the presence of Krishna. So Krishna's presence, it transforms things. You know? So by being here in this building, this is not an ordinary building. This is the spiritual world. You know, even though with our mundane senses we cannot perceive that, and with our mundane intelligence we cannot understand that, because the acharyas explain it like that, then we accept that yes, this is the spiritual world. And we're so fortunate is that we have this opportunity to reside in the spiritual world, even though we're here on planet Earth. Yeah? We reside in the spiritual world, even though we have telephones and the internet, etc., and all that sort of stuff going on in the mundane world. We're actually in the spiritual world because of the presence of Krishna and because of the presence of his holy name. There's actually, on this Nectar of Devotion, there's the Nectar of Devotion series that Prabhupada gives in Vrindavan in 76, there's a whole lot of nice lectures there. No, it's not 76, 72. And he was talking about Maya. And he was talking about how, he said, actually, everything is spiritual energy. And Krishna says that, aham sabhasya prabhu makasa, that everything comes from me. Prava comes from my energy, my potency. Yeah? And Prabhupada was saying that everything is spiritual energy. He said, Maya means forgetfulness of Krishna. So as long as you remember Krishna, you're situated in the spiritual energy. As soon as you forget Krishna, you're situated in the material energy. Everything, this everything here, is actually spiritual energy. But because it's not connected with Krishna, it's Maya. But as soon as we connect something with Krishna, as soon as we remember Krishna, as soon as we chant Krishna's names, then we're in the spiritual energy. So the trick is, as Lord Chaitanya points out in Shishastakam, is to Kirtanya Sadahari. You always are immersed in the name. You're always immersed in remembrance of the pastimes, remembrance of the activities, remembrance, as it's saying here, the beautiful form of the Lord. And as Lord Chaitanya points out, what does it say? It says, Trinadapi Sunichina Tororiva Sahishnana Amanina Maranina Kirtanya Sada. He's saying that it's more humble than the straw in the street. And you see, like, you don't see so much straw in the street here, but if you go to India, you can see, like, you go to some of the markets in Calcutta and stuff, you know, when they're bringing fragile goods, they pack them all up with dried straw to protect them. And there's so much straw on the street, you know, and they're coming, the tailors, they're coming and going with their carts, and they're rolling over the straw, and the rickshaws are coming and going, and people are walking, and animals are chewing, and, you know, and the straw just lies there on the street, no complaint. You know? So he's saying, you know, humble like the straw on the street. And we see with great Vaishnavas, like when Sanatan and Rupa, when they approached Lord Chaitanya, what did they do? They came and they held straw between their teeth and bowed down at Lord's lotus feet. You know, at Lord's feet, and just said, you know, we're nothing, we're insignificant, you please accept us as your servants. So humility. And he says, and then Toro Ivasa Hishnu, tolerant like the tree. And you see that, you know, no matter what happens, the tree just stands, you know, winter, summer, whatever, you know, horrible seasons, dogs coming and urinating on it, people coming with a chainsaw to chop it down, taking the fruit, taking the flowers, the tree just tolerates. Amanina manarina. You never expect any respect for yourself. Then you offer all respects to others. It says, in this way, you can chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. And then by chanting the holy name of the Lord constantly, then we're always absorbed in this spiritual atmosphere. It's the only way to do it. We cannot do it any other way. So Lord Chaitanya, in this one verse, he's establishing a very straightforward, important philosophical principle. If you want to become absorbed in Krishna's pastimes, you need to chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. If you want to be able to chant the holy name of the Lord constantly, then you have to develop these qualities. It's as simple as that. And it's not that difficult. You just give up false ego. Give up the false bodily concept of life. Because that is what causes us to be proud. That's what causes us to be intolerant. That's what causes us to want respect all the time. Is because we have this false bodily concept of life. We think that I'm important. But actually the reality is I'm insignificant. Huh? Anu, atomic, I'm so tiny, I'm so small. But Lord, the Lord is Vibhu. He's so great. He's so, significant. We need to, constantly remind ourselves of these things. It's so important that we understand this and apply it in our lives. And if we develop this mood that Lord Chaitanya talks about, then surely we'll be able to see these pastimes. We'll be able to enter into these pastimes. Just like with deity worship, I was discussing with one of the pujaris about talking on the altar. You don't talk on the altar. You never talk on the altar. Because why? We are there with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the most significant person. There is only one thing you do on the altar. You focus upon Krishna. You just go there, you do your service, you just focus upon that service, you're 100% focused. Right? It's just like, when you're in the presence of a great personality, if the spiritual master is there, you remember what Tamal Krishnamurti is like. Yeah? Would you have some side conversation, some joke when he was there? Never. He was a person who really understood relationships, and how to act, And the same when he was with Prabhupada. He was considered amongst all his godbrothers to be the best servant of Srila Prabhupada, because he was just completely focused upon pleasing Prabhupada. So in the same way, when we have this wonderful opportunity to serve Krishna in his deity form, completely focus upon pleasing the Lord. And in that way, the relationship will develop. When we understand our position, that I am a servant, you are my master. Then in this way, the relationship will develop more and more. But if we think, he's just one of the guys. Sometimes we hear, devotees addressing their deities as the boys. They have Gaunitai and they address them as the boys. Very familiar address. This isn't deity worship. This is not the mood of deity worship. Deity worship is Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, which means Aishwarya. We worship, the Prabhupada says, that even though this is Lord Krishna, he's standing there holding the flute. We worship in the mood of Lakshmi Narayan, which means Aishwarya. Great opulence, great awe and reverence. So this is, and that's why you see we dress the deities with great opulence. This is not Krishna's dress in Vrindavan. This is not how Lord Chaitanya dresses in Navadvip when he's performing Sankirtan. Nothing like this. Of course, Jagannath is like this because he's the Lord of the universe. He's dressed as a king. Yet we see, because of our position in devotional service, we need to understand where we're at. We're on the neophyte level. Therefore, we need to, practice devotional service in such a way that will help us to become elevated. But if we misunderstand the relationships, our practices will create problems for us. But if we understand the relationship, then things will go very smoothly and very quickly. So by understanding how we should act, by understanding the different relationships, and developing humility completely. You see, with all the acharyas, even like I was saying last time we came to class, I had been listening to the Mahabharata. And every time, I've listened to these Mahabharata tapes, it must be like 20 or 30 times by now, easily. And every time I listen to them, I'm just so astounded by Yudhisthira Maharaj's humility. Duryodhan was just an out-and-out demon. He's just a complete asura. He said he was the embodiment of Kali Yuga. He was such a horrible personality. There was nothing he wouldn't do to try to destroy, to subjugate, to just push down the Pandavas. Nothing he wouldn't do. He tried to poison Bhima. He tried so many different things. He'd send Durvasa Muni to try and curse them, etc., etc. When the Pandavas were in the forest after they had left the house of Lakat Varanavatar, then the Kauravas had gone. They were going somewhere to the Ganga to enjoy, and there happened to be a to swim in the river and count. I think they were going off to count the cows actually. Anyhow, there was a Gandharva sporting in the Ganga. His name was Chitrasen, and Gandharvas are very powerful people, extremely powerful. Anyhow, so when they came there, the Gandharva's warriors fought, because he had thousands of warriors with him. They fought with the Kauravas and defeated them. And actually, Duryodhana and Karna were putting up a bit of a fight. So then Chitrasen himself came and started to fight with the Kauravas. And Karna ran away, and he captured Duryodhana and tied him up. And then when the Pandavas heard about this, because the Pandavas were staying nearby, Bhima was, "Great! Now we get the kingdom back." He was really happy about it. And And then Eurystheus says, no, it is our duty, we must go and free them. And Bhima was just like, I don't believe this. You know, what are you saying? You know, this is what we've been waiting for. He says, no, the dignity of the Kuru house is at stake here. We cannot allow the name of the Kurus to be tarnished, so we must go and free them. So they went there, and he liberated, you know, he freed, Arjuna actually freed Duryodhana, and then the Gandhava Chitrasen became completely indebted. They had a friend, because he told these stories about the histories of, he was calling Arjuna Tapati, and Arjuna was confused, why are you calling him this? So then he explained the whole history about it, and then he gave Arjuna different benedictions and stuff like that, and Arjuna said, I don't want your benedictions, he says, I just want your friendship. So then they had this bond of friendship. So we see that even in situations like this where you know, someone like Yudhisthira, where he could use the situation to his advantage, you know, and actually he also wanted the kingdom, you know, because it was his duty, it was his right, his birthright to be the king. And, you know, because the Kauravas, particularly the sons of Dhritarashtra, were so impious that he knew it was his duty, but he didn't want to achieve these things by unfair means. So we see, you know, a Vaishnava is the embodiment of all good qualities. And it's our business, it's our duty to develop these qualities. Because one of the things about developing the qualities is that, you know, Prabhupada, he quotes this very interesting, I think it's Bengali, he says, Apriya Achari Prabhu Jivera Sikhoya. That first your behavior should become ideal, then you can preach. Because what happens is when you have ideal behavior, then people are inspired by this. They say, oh, he was such a nice person. I want to be like that. How do I become like that? Yeah? And then they'll understand, oh, through the process of devotional service you become like that. Because the process of devotional service is about developing saintly qualities. That's one of the aspects of it. Yeah? Because only those saintly persons can associate with Krishna. Only saintly persons can understand Krishna. So we need to develop those saintly qualities. And they're elaborating, you know, Kapila Dev, of course, about it in the third chapter. Krishna talks about it in the 13th chapter of the Gita. There's no shortage of information about what the qualities are of a Vaishnava. And then we actually develop these qualities, develop humility, we develop tolerance, we develop this simplicity, etc. Then we get the opportunity to be constantly chanting the names of Krishna, and we get the opportunity to, you know, enter into these pastimes as well. I'll just finish off with a verse here. The charming flute song then steals away the minds of the cranes, swans, and other lake-dwelling birds. Indeed, they approach Krishna, close their eyes, and maintaining strict silence, worship him by fixing their consciousness upon him in deep meditation. You imagine that, all these birds are becoming so struck by the sound of Krishna's flutes, they just come up close, and they can't do anything, they're just like closing their eyes and just meditating upon Krishna, and just... such a wonderful opportunity, so fortunate, you know, that they're actually directly in the association of the Supreme Person, even in the body of an animal, even in the body of a spider. You know, there's that story of how that spider was throwing grains of sand into the ocean to help Lord Ramachandra build the bridge to Lanka. Even in the body of a spider, an insect, one is so fortunate to come into contact with the Supreme Person of God. And they're not ordinary living entities, they're not ordinary birds. They're associates of the Supreme Lord. They're in a spiritual form. And because they're associates with Krishna, because they're transcendental living entities, then their whole being is simply dedicated to the worship and the glorification of Krishna. They have no other purpose in life. And this is our duty, you know, is to just focus our life upon Krishna consciousness, focus our life upon self-realization, to have no other duty. No other business. And if something, it's just like, you know, when we're writing lesson plans for teaching, like you have the goal or the outcome, the learning outcome you're looking for. And whatever supports that learning outcome, you put it into the lesson. And you may have like this really great learning experience. I've had this experience so many times. You may have this real great learning experience. Oh yeah, I really like this exercise. And you want to put it in the class, but then you need to look at the goal of the class. What is the goal of the class? Does this facilitate achieving that goal? And if not, get rid of it. Doesn't matter how good it is, you get rid of it because it has nothing to do with the goal. So the same way in our lives, We need to look at what is the goal of my life. The goal of my life is to become God conscious, to become to reinstate myself to my eternal relationship with Krishna. And anything else that does not serve that purpose is simply a waste of time. It will only serve to keep you from achieving Krishna or take you away from Krishna. So for devotees of the Lord, we're dedicated to this service of Krishna, and we need to focus like that. If something is going to help me become a better devotee of Krishna, and it doesn't mean that we reject all our relationships with our family, with our friends, within Krishna consciousness. I was listening to a class the other day, Prabhupada was talking about it. He says, no, it does not mean that you don't have affection for your wife. It does not mean that you don't have affection for your children, because they are also devotees of Krishna. But it means we understand the devotees of Krishna, and we act in a way that helps me to become Krishna conscious and also helps them to become Krishna conscious. This is what our life is for. Life is not for enjoyment. Life is not for sense gratification. This is, now that you have this, in the Vedanta Sutra it points this out, that now you have this human form of life, you use this human form of life in order to understand the nature of the Absolute Truth. And this is what is spoken here. This is the nature of the Absolute Truth. He's in Vrindavan with his associates, and he's enjoying extraordinary pastimes. You just cannot, even from these words, if we meditate upon these words, we get some understanding. Some, limited understanding, because we're limited. How much can we understand? But then when we go there, you give this life to Krishna, you become purified. At the end of this life, you will go there, and you will see. It's not just some story. It's true. It's real. And we can experience it through the process of Krishna consciousness. So, thank you very much. Is there any questions at all? But what was the name of that Gandharva? Chitrasen. It's the same Gandharva, as far as I understand. I could be easily be corrected on this, but as far as I understand, it was the same Gandharva. But you're correct. Yeah, I omitted those details. I forgot them. Thank you. I couldn't give you a reference. Do you know Keshava?
I've seen it written, but I don't know. Like, yeah. Sure. Don't know where it's from. It might be the Mahara or something.
You could try doing a database search on it. But I have read that. Not just heard it, but I've read it. I have a tendency not to be so dependent on things I hear. Rather, I like to see it in writing before I close it. But I'm pretty sure I've read that. But you may find it in the database, I'm not sure. But even if he's not the personification of Kali Yuga, which I'm pretty convinced he is, he was a pretty bad person. Even there was one point there, where Vidura had come back from the kingdom of Virat, because after the 13th year of exile, they were in Virat's kingdom. And Vidura was telling Dhritarashtra about the glories of Krishna and saying, you will never win this war because Krishna is on the side of the Pandavas. He is the Supreme Person of Godhead. So then Dhritarashtra wanted to correct his son, because he was starting to dawn upon him, we're finished here, we're doomed. And it's kind of interesting, because all along, Drona, Kripa, Bhishma, they'd all been telling him, you cannot defeat the Pandavas. They are the eternal associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This war will ruin. It will destroy the Kshatriya race. And the whole time they're just saying this, and it just didn't dawn. But when Vidura came back, and he heard this, so then he said, come with me. And they went into the inner palace with Vidura, Dhritarashtra, and Duryodhana. And so he was telling Duryodhana who Krishna is. And Duryodhana says, I do not care, I will not surrender, have peace with my enemy. Krishna was his enemy. And that is a demon. One who thinks that the Lord is his enemy. One who thinks he can kill the Supreme Person of Godhead. You look at all the big demons, Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, you know, Ravana, Kamsa, they all thought they were going to kill Krishna. And that was Duryodhana, that was his nature. Such a, you know, big demon. And it's actually, in the version of the Mahabharata that Sri Gilim reads from, they don't talk about this, but in the translation work that Sri Dhananamaraj was doing, he talks about the history more, you know, about how it came to this point. And what had happened was that the Devas had defeated the demons, the Danavas, the Daityas, and therefore they had developed a plan to, you know, conquer the universe. So what they did is they all entered into the families of different Kshatriyas on the planet Earth, you know, they just had this plan to, you know, overtake the demigods. And you see that, you know, so many of these Kshatriyas were very proud and arrogant, you know, Shishupal, Dantavakra, Jarasandha, Duryodhana and his 100 brothers, actually 99 of the brothers, because one of the brothers was actually quite not a bad person. You know, you see there's so many powerful warriors, and Krishna says that he had descended to, you know, to rectify that situation. So, yeah, he was not a good person. David? Yeah, I was using children in the sense of the relationship rather than children in the sense of the age. Usually when it's young children, like, you know, minors, then yes, it's a forceful thing. But I have known people as teenagers and older who have had conjugal relationships with their parents, willingly. You know, so that's just, you know, I agree with you completely. When they're children, then it's molestation or rape or whatever you want to call it. And it's forced, and it's a very, you know, horrible thing. Yet I know of people, even I knew one devotee